Hello, dear listeners. Our New Year's gift to you is this very special bonus episode and interview with someone who we know is going to help you kick off your writing year in a really excellent mindset. On having the right mindset for the new year, check out the link in our show notes to a workshop that I'll be running for Writers Victoria on January 29th. It's all online, so you can join from anywhere. And it's called Basics for Beginning Writers. It will be a day jam-packed full of ideas and exercises to plan your creative year. Make sure you do subscribe to the podcast and keep an eye on our feed, because despite what we said about not being back until March with our planned Masters series, we are in fact going to be in your ears over January and February as we deep dive on the brand new book from my co-host Catherine Collette. We'll take you behind the scenes in some mini episodes over the next few weeks before the competition hits shelves on February 1st. Stay tuned. Madeline Dorr is a freelance writer, interviewer, and founder of Extraordinary Routines. Since 2014, Dorr has been asking creative thinkers how they navigate their days on her popular blog, Extraordinary Routines, and her podcast, Routines and Ruts. Her interviews, life experiments, and articles have appeared in Sunday Life, Womankind, BBC, and more. And her latest offering is her very first book. It's called I Didn't Do the Thing Today, on letting go of productivity guilt. It's published in Australia and in the US in January 2022. Madeline Dorr, I have been a longtime fan of yours, I have to say. I have been obsessed with the Extraordinary Routines blog and newsletter. And I think that probably it's partly because we share this obsession with, I'm going to call it an obsession. Maybe it's just an interest.
I'm with you. And I feel the mutual love obsession.
Yes. It's like, I want to know, like you do, how creative people do their thing in their days and then in their lives and all the things. So, you know, when I heard that you had a book coming out, I was super duper excited. And then when I knew I was going to get to speak to you, even more so. And I've just been telling you, I've just finished your amazing new book, I Didn't Do the Thing Today. And it is so good. It's so good. So I'm very excited to welcome you to the podcast.
Oh, well, thank you, Kate. And the love is just right back at you, because I think that the first time pod is one of the most juicy and delicious in terms of just going right into that writing process. And you do it so well. And I can feel the shared curiosity and obsession because it's just so mystifying how people do what they do. So I'm right with you in this little bubble.
I'm so glad. We're going to go deep. And there is actually so much to cover, because not only do, you know, we're going to release this as a special kind of bonus episode for the brand new year of 2022, which we're all hoping is going to be just fabulous after what we've had for the last two. So I want people to be able to take that wisdom that you've got in the book into the new year. But I also am really interested to kind of turn it around on you and go, well, Madeline Dorr, how do you put yourself through your days to get to something like this? So for that reason, we're going to go back to the beginning for you. And I want to ask if you remember the very first time that you ever had your writing published or you shared it in some kind of forum that gave you a thrill, when you went, oh, maybe this is something that I can do.
Ooh, we'll see. I know that you asked this question, so I've already prepared
excellent
for this one. And it was interesting because is it the first time that we shared our writing with someone, or is it the first time it's in print? And it's a beautiful sort of flexible question. And what actually popped into mind was when I was probably 11, I compiled all these short stories that I wrote outside of class. So I had a very encouraging year five and year six teacher, and she was very, very encouraging of my writing and would, you know, give me a stack of books every month or so. And I compiled this little compendium of short stories. I was probably about 10 of them. And I went to my mum's work and got them all bound and put the plastic cover on them, and I gave them to friends and family, and I gave them to my grandmother. And it was quite interesting because she was so, again, really encouraging and really blown away by the short stories. And there was one about her and I remember so distinctly that she said to me, don't ever stop. Make sure that you don't stop. I stopped and I regret it. And in that moment, I remember thinking, wait a second. This is something that can stop. This isn't something that just flows from you. And it was really well intended what she was saying. It was meant to be encouraging. But I think that was for me that point where all of a sudden I became aware. I became aware that you can become self-conscious about something. And it's when it introduced the inhibitions. So before that, there was no inhibitions. It was just me making these stories and sharing them and feeling encouraged. But then seeing that, oh, wait, this can stop. And it's really interesting to think back on that now, because I think that that has what's driven extraordinary routines, because I want to know how people didn't stop or don't stop or keep going or deal with the self-consciousness or deal with the self-doubt and keep going even when the flow is not there, or embrace the ebb and flow. And so, yeah, I did stop for a really long time after that, which was really quite interesting. And then it took a while to kind of swing back. I turned to journalism, but then I left studying journalism, and I've kind of had these fits and starts throughout my writing career and really sort of trying to untangle what that is and what that secret to continuing is.
That's such an interesting way of kind of reframing it, and an interesting origin story for that fear of how do you keep being a creative? Because lots of people that we talk to, they often answer that question with, the story that comes from it is something about not knowing that this was a legitimate kind of a want and ambition. You know, you can't be a writer. Like, that's not a thing to be. So that's really interesting how your fear was just the stopping of the creativity.
Yeah, that it wasn't just something that you can keep, or that there's a guarantee, I suppose. And it's just so interesting how we can internalize things so differently. Like, it can be even the most encouraging words can be something that plants a seed of doubt, or it can be people are actively discouraged from doing something. So just goes to show.
Well, that's interesting too, because if you're actively discouraged, often there is, especially for creatives, there's that little bit of kind of bolshy stubbornness, which says, no, I'm going to do it anyway. Whereas it's those other potentially well-intentioned kind of seeds of doubt that are planted that can be ones that kind of really whiten you, I suppose, from the inside.
You're so right, Kate. Yeah, it could almost be this added pressure to be the best, or can add to that kind of perfectionist tendency.
Absolutely. Oh my gosh, we're going to go so deep on perfectionism. But first, your bio now is the kind that gives me such a thrill. But for a long time, it's the kind of bio that also gave me incredible anxiety, because I would be like, you know, write a podcast to interview, but like, where does the salary come from? Like, where's the actual, you know, like, how can you do that? How can you be that? And I want to ask you, how different or similar is that kind of bio, or the way that you might describe yourself in terms of what your job is, to the life that you imagined for yourself?
Ooh, well, that's really interesting, Kate, because a lot of those things that are in my bio, you're right in that the salary doesn't come from those things. Like, the salary definitely doesn't come from doing the podcast or extraordinary routines and all of these things that, pad out the bio. They're all labors of love. So there've been things that I've done on the side when I had the capacity or the time or the interest and the curiosity. And so it's really been driven from, no one was giving me these opportunities or these paid opportunities to do the things that I wanted to do. So I had to forge ahead and do them myself. But that meant that there was limited time for them, limited resources. Everything's behind the scenes very scrappy, because it is me editing the podcast. It is me doing every single little bit. And so it's interesting to see that you can pursue these things that you want to be doing, but it just might mean that you don't do them, you know, as prolifically as someone who might be doing them and getting compensated for it, or might have a blog that has advertising on it and then can kind of have this really consistent content calendar. That's something that I've been self-conscious of for so long, is that I didn't have this consistency to my projects. But then I had to kind of take a step back and see that, I'm doing them as a labor of love. It's born out of my own curiosity. So I can pick them up and put them down depending on my own schedule and paid work. And so for a long time, income was through either staff writing roles or freelance editorial, freelance content creation or content writing. And so it was all sort of, I suppose, behind the scenes, whereas I put my labors of love forward first. And that did change with the book. And obviously the book and the advance gave this amazing opportunity for the first time in my whole career to actually focus on one thing instead of a million different bitsy freelance projects or side projects and that juggle. And so, yeah, I suppose I didn't quite imagine that bio, but in some ways I did, because I was just doing what it is that I wanted to do, and finding a way to scrap it all together.
It's so interesting when you look at someone who does freelance work, and I think from the outside that people might think, oh, that's incredible. Like, they're doing what they love. Like, they've made this job for them, and they imagine it as all together. And I have tried to do this, I think, myself as well, gone, oh yeah, well, you know, I'm a writer and a podcaster, I'm all these things and they're all the one thing. And actually that pressure that we put on ourselves to make the labor of love pay or to, you know, do all of those things makes it far more difficult. And so when you, do you separate them out? Like, you talk about extraordinary routines and that work as being your labors of love and then your other freelance work. How do you separate those things out in your head? You know, how do you kind of make space or weigh them up against each other?
I wonder if I do separate them out. I feel as if maybe I'm so deadline driven that I think the freelance work always takes precedent, or whatever the paid thing that has a deadline and there's someone waiting for it. There's just a greater motivation for it. And I think that with my labors of love, often I think I'm quite, I think I have quite a slow creative process. And that's something I've had to learn to embrace as well, is that I'm not someone who churns something out really frequently. I sort of sit with things and have come to allow things to take the time that they take. And I almost get to this, I feel almost itchy. And I think, okay, oh, it's time to actually write on something, or, oh, it's time to sort of put together this second season of the podcast, or, oh, it's time to release the interview. But I sit and I languish with things for quite a while. And maybe that is in part of, you know, me doing them when I have the time, but also maybe overthinking things as well, that perfectionism coming back into it with the labors of love. And so I think that in terms of separating them out, I think that it's quite clear in terms of deadlines, and I'm very organized with any freelance commissions and kind of have a budget tracker and make sure that I'm sort of hitting the targets that I need to hit. And that's kind of quite separate and quite organized. Whereas the labor of love, it's sort of always a constant sort of hum and a little voice saying, you should return to that. You should be, have a look at that. And that's why I have had to create these elaborate structures at times to get myself to do those things that are deadline-less, and they're just this itch. And that's where things like a project that I had for a while called Side Project Sessions, where people would come together and work. And it would be this sort of peer pressured productivity for people who were putting things off. We would get together and we'd work for 3 hours in these sort of timed Pomodoro style sessions. And I needed that external accountability of organizing event that people would turn up to get myself to do the labor of love and finally scratch that itch. Because, yeah, I do have a tendency to put things off. But I think that's when you're juggling a lot of other things, maybe that's to be expected.
Absolutely. You did mention there again, perfectionism though, and I want to go to that, because you describe in the book how some perfectionists are fragile perfects, and I related to this so much. And I often tell the story when I'm teaching of how the very first time I failed at writing in my head, when I didn't place in a competition. So I was, you know, in my early 20s, and I gave up. Like, bang, it's done. I'm clearly no good at this. I'm going to give it up. And I tell writers this kind of to urge them to fail more, to fail regularly, like to put yes. themselves out there again and again and again, because it was only, I mean, I'd like to think that instinctively I would have come back to writing anyway, but it was a good 10 years before I did. So I want to know if there's a time when you started embracing mistakes more, or when you recognized that perfectionism was something that was not serving you in your life.
Yeah, I think it's amazing how sometimes one person telling you something, there's such a theme of this already, can really shift things. And I'm friends with Spencer Harrison, who's a wonderful artist, and I love his trajectory from more of a graphic design background to now fully fledged artist. And he was someone who really inspired me in terms of having lots of side projects and just trying things creatively. And he was someone who did a lot of daily challenge type projects. He would do a design a day kind of thing, which has always blown me away because I've never managed to do something daily like that. But he was really encouraging of extraordinary routines back in 2014 when I had the seed of the idea. And again, I was putting it off in this perfectionist type of way. I was waiting to get someone to design my website for me so that then I could launch. I put all these blocks in front of me, these things that needed to be done and perfect before I could release the interviews that I had finished. And it's interesting to see it. That's, I think, quite a common trait of perfectionism, is to make sure that you have all the right tools first and make sure that you get the perfect microphone before you start a podcast and all of these things. And he could see that in me, that I was putting it off until I had it perfect. And then he just said that done is better than perfect. Mm. And that really helped switch things. And he was kind enough to show me Squarespace and just give me a little tour of how to set that up. And I saw that it could just be done great, like perfectly, on, not perfectly, I'll rewind with that. It can be done adequately on Squarespace, and then I can release it and then start to experiment as it unfolds. And I think I saw that in that moment, you have to start in order to learn and to then keep iterating with something. And it, otherwise you've got nothing to work with if you're not starting. And so I think every time I did an interview, or every time I put out a piece, or every time I started a different project, or even side project sessions as an event series, you know, each event you're learning. And so you just need that thing to be working with to be able to learn something, because nothing happens if we're just waiting for the perfect time to arrive or the perfect tools. So I think just beginning can be the momentum that you need. And I think that still means that sometimes you can face that block again, and sometimes you can lose that momentum and it's hard to start back up again. I don't know how you feel with but in between seasons of your podcast, whether it's sort of harder at that beginning of each season to like, oh, okay, we've got to get this moving again. But once the momentum's there, I think that that can be a powerful thing in and of itself, to kind of embrace that failure and keep ticking along.
I love what you say there about also having the thing up to learn how to iterate with it, because I think I've been very into George Saunders' new book, A Swim in the Pond in the Rain. And one of the things that I keep coming back to is this idea of intuitive iteration. And that's how he talks about his drafting process. And so often what we end up saying to emerging writers, which is, you got to get the draft down. Like, you got nothing until you got the draft. You can, your idea may be perfect. And it's Saunders' analogy again to, you know, the kind of glass bauble, which is this perfect orb of the story that you want to write. And then you begin and it smashes to pieces in front of you, because you can never match, you know, the ambition for it. But you also can't do anything until you've got that shitty first draft down, because there's nothing to work with. So I love that.
Yes, we need something to work with. And we also need to hate it a little bit. I've come to embrace that as well, in terms of there's always going to be this point where we want to throw the thing out or delete the draft or whatever it is. We need to get to that point too, because that's this wonderful tension point where we actually improve the thing. And that's where I think there's actually this upside to perfectionism. If we see it in that sense, it's that alert to, oh, we can actually do better, and we can tweak something. And so it's just that fine line between knowing when we're in that moment where we do want to sort of challenge ourselves and really get the best from us. And that's such a satisfying part of the creative process, I think, the hating it, going from the hating it to the, oh, wow, look what I've created. But then making sure it doesn't stifle us to the point that we never actually finish it or share it or feel like that satisfaction from doing the thing.
I like that hating it a little bit, that tension point. I really like that. It's making me think about if you were to draw it, I suppose, in that extraordinary routines journey, which has been some time now, like more than 6 years.
Yeah.
8 years.
Yeah, maybe 8 years.
What was the kind of steepest learning curve along that path? Was it at the beginning? I mean, that seems like a natural thing. Or were there points where you were really trying to change something or shift it?
Just looking at the trajectory in my mind, I think that this is a big reminder for myself constantly, is to not take things so seriously. I think there were so many crisis points where I was worried about not having enough newsletter subscribers or enough followers on social media or doing enough interviews with it or the caliber of interviewees that I was wanting or media coverage and all of these sort of really heavy, serious things that actually are irrelevant. If we take it back to this was a project that was driven by my own curiosity and the curiosity and obsession that we both share, Kate, of trying to understand how people do what they do. And whether or not you have a certain number of social media followers or not doesn't change your own curiosity and enjoyment and learning and discovery of something. And so when I would get quite stressed and anxious about the project itself not being good enough or prominent enough or successful enough and all these really amorphous things that are impossible to measure anyway, that's when I'd get quite stuck with it and it would lose its shimmer. And I think that it's so easy to do that with many different projects when we hold onto it too tightly and we kind of suffocate it with our own expectation. And when we can kind of loosen the grip there and just remind ourselves, this is something I enjoy doing and this is something that feeds my own curiosity and I can hold it a bit more lightly. And I think I have to remind myself of that with so many things. And I think that that's been a wave that I've had to bob along. And when I've encountered that tension point, just tried to kind of relax back into things and not take it so seriously and see it for the labor of love that it is rather than this thing that has to define me or lead to something, because the things that it has led to weren't planned for at all when I first started it. And so that's the thing to remind myself, is that you can't actually maneuver things anyway, so just enjoy it.
Wise words. The other reason that I feel, I think, such affinity with you, Madeline, is because nearly every single one of the productivity tools and tricks and things that you mention in the book and during, you know, your podcast and extraordinary routines, I've tried them. So, you know, David Allen's stuff, bullet journaling, Pomodoro, you know, I have accountability email friends. I've tried all of them in an effort to make myself the most shiny, productive, efficient, optimized version of myself. And of course, realize that none of them have actually fixed me and I have never got to the end of the list, you know, so it's an ongoing, I'm kind of going through the same process. And just last week, in fact, not realizing the correlation, I read or listened to the audiobook of Oliver Berkman's 4,000 Weeks. And I came home, I was away writing while I was listening to it. I came home and I said to my partner, my life has changed. Like, my life has changed. I'm now getting it. And of course, Oliver Berkman has done an endorsement for your amazing book. And so when I followed it up by reading your book, I was like, amazing. Like, this is now, and you describe it as a permission slip for me to approach this idea of being the most efficient human being I can be in a really different way. And in fact, to let that go. So I want to know your journey through kind of productivity.
Yes.
When did you realize that you had to let some of the things go?
you said it so beautifully, Kate. Just when I tried them all and they didn't work, I didn't stick to them. They became something to stumble over more so than the original stumbling block of perfectionism or procrastination or not doing the thing consistently, trying to put these rigid tips and tools and hacks in place to then, you know, be more productive or be more prolific. I was kind of missing the point. So I think a lot of people can sort of, this was really amplified during the pandemic when so much of the advice was, well, you know, and still are part of the pandemic, obviously. But so much of the advice early on was to get a routine and to try this tip and hack to kind of keep this element of control. And there was this productivity pressure to get a hobby or to make sourdough and all of these things. And then when those things didn't work, we were just left with feeling worse about ourselves, because not only did we have an initial sense of anxiety and dread, but then we had this layer of shame and guilt on top of that for having failed at the thing that was meant to fix us. And so I think that I kept seeing that no matter how many drafts of a routine that I would write and then wake up and think, oh, this is the one, this is the routine that's going to work for me. And I will get up at 6 a.m. effortlessly and then meditate for 20 minutes and then write in my journal and then go for a run and then have a healthy breakfast and then work uninterrupted for 4 hours. And then day after day, you know, sleeping through that alarm and the whole thing toppling over in one go, I just started to see that this isn't, it isn't working. And so it was really humbling and inspiring to hear people say that they're not routined either. Like, they're higgledy-piggledy. They wake up at different times. They're ad hoc. And it was something I was able to start to see, that people just kind of construct their days and go with the flow a little bit more. And it was interesting to see that when I put those tips and hacks and structures to the side and just allowed myself to sort of go into the day, I found myself, interestingly, more productive or more efficient or more engaged, because I was no longer tripping over myself constantly. And it's funny, because those things, when we might need them or want them or feel more, I don't know, akin with them, they do sort of, they're a little bit easier to stick to. So I think something like exercise is a really good example. When I tried to kind of put it into this rigid box and exercise at a certain time and follow a certain structure or schedule, it took all the joy out of it. And I found myself not really, it was all for this sort of measurable outcome of changing myself and changing my body. But when it was no longer about that and it was about feeling good, it became so much easier to implement in my day. And I think that that's a sort of metaphor for the other kind of habits, is that when we do it because it makes us feel good or we want to, it's so simple. It's like when we want to do something, we might find ourselves doing it or we need to, or it's delightful or we enjoy it, then we can return to these things and they actually sort of fit in our day a little bit easier. So I think just, yeah, loosening the grip again on these habits. I feel like I've really rambled with this one.
No, that's brilliant, because that's exactly it. I think it is the loosening the grip. The kind of irony, I suppose, of it is that in reading the book, you've spent so long really getting down to the kernel of how people do things and what works for them. And I suppose also coming from this, the kind of brain that does want routines and structures and tips and hacks, is that you've managed to kind of package it all in this way where you can open your book and go, okay, here's a bunch of ways that I can make choices better. But you've managed to do it in a way where the grip is quite loose, because I came out of it thinking, oh my gosh, what happens now if I've like joined the cult of Oliver Berkman and Madeleine Dorr and now I just do my life this way? This is another way to do my life. But it's not like that. It doesn't read like that.
Oh, good. Yes, because that's the thing, is the prescriptive advice, I think, ignores so much how each of us varies. And not only do each of us vary in so many varying ways in terms of our energy and attention and life circumstance and neurodiversity and mental and physical health, but our days vary as well. And I think that these recipes, these hacks, expect this sort of uniformity of human beings to be able to stick to these things and ignore that life happens. And so I think that if we can take away the prescription a little bit, maybe that's the cult that I would want to be part of, or is that there is no one way, and that, it's about honouring that we're all varying, and so we can't have these blanket hacks.
There's some really lovely moments in there where you also help show, you know, the kind of things life is throwing at us, I suppose, in the modern world, and also kind of some of the historical references, which are hilarious as well, you know, about the crazy amount of news that's coming when the newspaper comes twice a day. I just laughed out loud in that. But this idea of, for instance, the paradox of choice now, which I think is so helpful in the way you go into it. And there's then this amazing list of the ways that one might attempt to address different kinds of choices in their life. Can you just talk a little bit about that idea, that the paradox of choice, and also that, is it infinite browsing mode?
Infinite browsing mode, yes.
Oh my gosh, that yes. Got me.
Yeah. Oh, it's... So which one do I start with? Because it's well, I guess they're so interlinked in this paradox, the paradox of choice, which there's a great TED talk by Barry Swartz, which goes into this whole idea. But the paradox being that we think that we want more choice, that more choice means more happiness and more contentment, because there's more things to choose. But actually it gets to a certain point where we become so overwhelmed by that choice that it doesn't actually make us any happier at all. In fact, it can make us anxious and stifled by indecision, because we can't choose between all these great options. And I spoke to Patrick McGuinness, who created the term FOBO, which is the fear of better options. So even when we do make a choice, we fear that we've made the wrong one and there's some other better choice out there. And he calls this an affliction of affluence. So it's this the paradox and the affliction being that those with more choices tend to be those with more affluence or more opportunity or more privilege, and yet become completely stifled by all of this opportunity that they have. So infinite browsing mode, just that idea that I'm sure we've all done this, you know, when you're on Netflix and you're flicking through and you spend an hour searching for a film, or you might even start different series and films for 5 minutes, you think, oh no, not this one, this isn't the right one, and so you look for another option, and there's an hour can go by, or you can do it, you know, searching for what to order on Uber Eats.
Took me 8 years to buy a couch, you know.
Eight years
to buy a couch. Yeah, couldn't decide.
Yeah, because you're infinitely browsing.
Absolutely.
And we do that with our lives, our romantic lives, our careers, constantly in infinite browsing mode. And then when you're in infinite browsing mode, you're not actually settling on an option to then live that out and to actually be experiencing life. Like you're sort of not in the, there's this beautiful description of it, or a beautiful metaphor of, you know, we're just wandering the hallways when we're in infinite browsing mode, rather than actually walking into a room and settling in and seeing what's there for us. And so I think that we can be forever suspended. And then it relates back to this idea that we just spoke about earlier, about in terms of perfectionism, or this idea of failing more and iterating. If we're wandering the hallways, or we're stuck in infinite browsing mode, or we're, caught in this fear of better options, then we're not actually beginning something. We're not actually walking a path to do something and to learn something and to be engaging with the world and to be iterating, to be living, essentially.
Yeah.
We're browsing. So I think that's where it can be in some ways a waste, or we're caught in this overthinking. And something that's really helped me switch with this is to recognize that a choice is as good as any, because there's no such thing as the right decision anyway. We don't know how a previous decision can impact the decision that we're making now, and there's all these tiny little threads. So a decision can be as good as any.
I think that's, I think it's something, it seems so damn simple, right? Like it seems so simple, but I have to remind myself again and again, and almost on a daily basis, you know, that's one of the things that has really changed, I think, the way that I deal with my own anxiety and living with anxiety, is just to recognize that a choice must be made. There is not a perfect choice. There's not a perfect gift. There's not a perfect way to pack the camping trailer. There's not a perfect kind of a way to approach the book, for instance. One just has to go at it. I love that chapter. Yeah, love all the chapters, but I love that.
Thank you. You're so right. It's surprisingly simple, but we forget.
Yeah, we forget. Mm. I was coming back from a Christmas thing yesterday with my sister, and I was like, oh, I get to talk to Madeline Dorr tomorrow. Like, what would you like to ask? And she said, oh, can she just tell me how to say no? You've been doing kind of different episodes in the lead up to the book coming out, describing your own routines and ruts. And you said in the podcast, saying no doesn't equal being mean. Mm. I was like, gosh, I need to just write that and put it above my laptop for every email that comes in, and just remind myself that saying no doesn't equal being mean. Can you tell us how you came to that particular conclusion?
Yes. Oh, I think that's, again, this another simple epiphany for the people pleaser, because I think that, like many who struggle with saying no, it's because maybe our default is yes, and our default is yes because we want to people please. We want to be nice. We want to make sure that we don't disappoint other people. And yet I think that when we say yes, when we really meant no, that can actually lead to such messy, entangled situations that end up being far more disappointing than if we had just said no in the first place. But I think I have to constantly remind myself that because my default is yes, and it's almost become an unconscious response when being asked something, I have to pause, and even just for a second or two, and ask myself whether I do want to say yes or whether I do want to say no. Mm. And that kind of has its own kind of process to figure out as well, as when's it a yes and when's it a no for you. But once I can sort of have that moment to reflect, or even ask for it if you do need more than a second or two, can say, do you mind if I just circle back to you? I just need to have a think about that and look at my schedule or whatever it is. We can actually ask for some time. and that's another thing that I think there can be such a pressure or a rush to get these immediate responses. Mm. And even just how quickly you can even get, sorry for the delayed email. It's such an interesting thing. And that delayed email could have been for the afternoon. It's like, oh, why are you sorry? It's sort of like, let's normalize taking our time to respond to people perhaps. But once you have taken that pause, and then knowing that someone's asked you a question. And so if it's a question, it's an offer that they've put out there, and that offer can be accepted or declined. We can say yes or no. They're the options that have been presented to us by default of having been asked a question. And so who's to say that there needs to be a layer of meanness added to the one that's declining, when that's been presented to us anyway? And so I think that it was really important for me to realize that saying no doesn't actually equal being mean, because it's an option for me in the first instance to say no. And so I think it can actually be the kinder thing, both to yourself, if you really do need to say no to something, but also to the other person, because then you're not getting tangled up, and there's more clarity. And so I'm just thinking of a specific decline that I made. And then if I had said yes instead of no when I meant no, I would have been teaching that person that it's okay, or that I am inviting an interruption, and then therefore have more requests to field in the future, making it harder and harder to say no politely, because I've been confusing in terms of saying yes previously when I really meant no. And so I think it is the kind of thing to do.
Yeah, I think it is, you know, for the first time this year, it's absolutely my habit. I'm a people pleaser from way back. And for the very first time this year, and I think because, like for so many of us, the kind of lockdowns and the pandemic were the straw that broke the camel's back. And so lots of aspects of our lives that have kind of been humming along at surface level, at least, kind of broke down. And I realized for the first time in my life, I had to withdraw a yes, you know, too late. And it was kind of poor practice on my behalf. And I felt really bad about it. And I did it, and I had to do it a number of times. And it was then, okay, lesson learned, you know, you should not have said yes to that one in the first place. And you really need to make some changes. And I wish that I hadn't got to that point, because it was, you know, difficult for everyone involved. But I think, hopefully have learned my lesson on that one now.
Yes. Yeah. We keep encountering those lessons, I think, to remind us.
We do. Love a lesson, love a life lesson. I was really interested in the chapter on curiosity, because I think curiosity and also awe as a word are words that have been really bouncing around in my brain a lot, and I think in the world a lot this year. I'm thinking Brooke McCallery's new book that came out. I'm thinking, you know, I was so obsessed with Maggie Shipstead's novel Great Circle, Julia Baird in Phosphorescence, like this idea of kind of awe in the natural world and being curious in the world around us. Tell us a little bit about how you have come to kind of nourish curiosity. You're clearly already a very curious person in terms of being driven by curiosity into other people's lives. But how are you nourishing it on a daily kind of basis for yourself?
Beautiful, curious question, Kate. How do I do that daily? It's interesting to think about, because I wonder if it is just become part of, I wonder if it is more of a value than an action. And so to think of actions is a little bit more, it's less tangible, because I think curiosity is a lens. And so I think that there's something that's, it does come back to me. So curiosity, I think, is something that has helped pull me out of ruts quite profoundly. So I see it as this wonderful antidote to difficulties and problems and the daily knocks that we can encounter. Maybe that's sort of more so how it comes up on a daily basis, because I think there can be little daily knocks that we all experience. And I think it's important to feel those things and feel the frustration and the sadness or the grief, whatever it might be. But sometimes there becomes a point in whatever difficulty or challenge or hardship we might be experiencing, or heartbreak, where something sort of softens and there's a little opening. I think some, you know, people might define it as the crack where the light gets in. And maybe that comes back to this beautiful idea of awe. But when we can sort of see that, that's when we can really use curiosity to pick something up from the experience. And I think that goes back to learning, which I think we're both circling around, which is a beautiful thing. That's where we can pick up that lesson that's all important. That's when we can sort of deepen into the experience. So in the book, I really speak about how we've got this sort of, we're embedded in this society that's obsessed with doing and productivity and output. And perhaps there's nothing wrong with doing things. We all need to, and productivity has a value, but perhaps creativity is this antidote, because creativity expands, whereas productivity narrows. And then I think deeper than that is curiosity. So we've got creativity expanding our lives and the ways we can approach things. We need to take a creative lens, but the lens of curiosity deepens everything. And whether that is deepening the lessons from a hardship or deepening even something like enjoyment. So I think that's how I use it. And then I turn it into learning, because there's this beautiful T.H. White quote, which is, the best thing for being sad is to learn something. And so that one line has seen me actively seek out different classes that I've attended, but also it's pushed me into the world more. So during those difficult times, during those ruts and heartbreaks, it's meant that where can I learn? Where can I learn from a conversation, or where can I learn from this experience itself, or a book, or where can I learn from just sort of smiling at the cashier rather than just sort of blankly kind of going through the checkout? So I think that's where it can be really helpful and be a balm for anxiety and sadness and grief and all of those things that are difficult.
I think those two ideas too, the curiosity and the learning, and And it just struck me then that one of those actions, and you talk about this a lot, is that paying attention, you know, and that what you're doing, paying attention to the person that you're speaking with, paying attention to the moment that you're in, paying attention to what happened so you can understand if there is a lesson to be learned from it, you know, just paying attention to the world is part of that, is, you know, it feeds the curiosity, feeds the learning. It's what I always kind of, I've got that written up in front of me as well, to pay attention. It's all, often also the way that creativity comes to us. I know Charlotte Wood talks about that, you know, pay attention to the things that keep coming up in your world as well, because they're often the things that, you know, you're meant to be investigating more as well.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Yeah, they go hand in hand, don't they? I think
they do. I want to talk a little bit about the process, because it's a book jam-packed with wisdom. And even just as you're speaking about it and being able to kind of pull these quotes out from everywhere, I wonder if you have a system for collecting ideas as you go, which is, you know, ironic asking you to give me a hack for collecting your wisdom as you go. But I feel like you've got the wisdom in there from the interviews and the learning from that, but also from your very extensive reading. I've just started a PhD, but I was like, this is a PhD in here. The way that you've kind of drawn all the ideas in like they're coming into a magnet. But how do you collect those as you go about your daily life and kind of articulate them and draw them all together?
Yes. Ooh, I think you're going to love this if you're doing a PhD, Kate, congrats, by the way. The topic sounds beautiful. It's about diaries and journals, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah. Yeah. Creativity.
Beautiful. So lots of different processes over the years, and a lot of spreadsheets actually in terms of collecting quotes and themes. That was one approach. But then I discovered Milanote, M-I-L-A-N-O-T-E.
Oh,
and,
my goodness.
I did some work for them, content writing. So that's answering a previous question about the income.
Yeah.
So it's a startup in Melbourne, and it's a bit of a fusion between Evernote and Trello and a blank canvas.
Oh my goodness. It's gonna blow my mind.
I wish I could give you a tour of my Milanote. So it's what I really love about it is that it's an infinity canvas. I'm not paid by them anymore, but I'm going to get excited.
But
it's an infinity canvas, and you can create these boards. And so I've got different boards for different ideas, book ideas, newsletter, social media, like to collect in different categories. And so for the book, I had a specific book board, and then you can create these columns and you can move everything around. It's all completely flexible. But then the columns were where I would start to collect the chapter ideas. And then what I did is actually reread the whole Extraordinary Routines interview archive and
wow.
the Routines and Ruts archive when I was, because it was, you know, as you said, it was 6 to 7 years of
it's huge.
Interviews and things. And I sort of wanted to get all those gems compiled. And so when I was reading those, I started to organize the quotes that I was collecting under the chapter headings, because I did a very extensive book proposal in the first instance, which was very helpful. It took months and months and months, or years if you think about it, to do the book proposal. But it just meant that I had everything organized and ready to go. And so I knew that when I was rereading my archive, I could start to categorize things. And the same goes for any articles that I had collected. I could start to rearrange them into the columns and quotes that I had found in books and so on. And so once I'd done that, I could export the column from Milanote into a Word document. And it meant that I had this chapter and no blank page. So I already had something on the page for the chapter, and it became a process of starting to just, you know, when you're writing, it can be this beautiful jigsaw puzzle moment. And so it was really just arranging that, and then I could start to edit and write. And I had the quotes as almost this scaffolding, and some great advice I had from my editor was, you need to put yourself there. I was hiding behind the quotes. And so I had to sort of start to really prune those as well. But that was the process of collecting, and I'm sort of already – I continue to use that as the main place to organize different clippings, quotes and everything that I find, and start to find themes for different articles that I might write.
Oh my gosh, I'm so excited.
Yeah, it's a really great tool for that. I think it's wonderful for PhD organizing, and it's just kind of, it's how my brain works, sort of all, it goes from sort of messy to organized, which I think is a really great.
I love that. Yeah. There's something in there that really stuck out because you definitely are in the book, but this is why it was so interesting to talk to you because you have talked to so many extraordinary people. There is this sense, I imagine, that you want to step back behind that wisdom. Was that the hardest thing for you in the book writing process, putting yourself in there, or was there something else that you found really tricky?
I think it was the hardest part. I think it's been the hardest part. I think it'll be the hardest part now, like even right now talking to you, it's the hardest part to start to share Madeline Dawe's ideas.
Yeah.
But I think it's been a bubbling up. I think that I became so comfortable being the question asker. There's a lot of, you can really hide behind that. I really love other people's wisdom. Like I when I'm interviewing people, I often just would be in awe of like, how does your brain contain all these beautiful gems, and how did you learn that, and where does this come from, how do you know how to answer a question? It would blow me away. And so I think I'm always by default going to be in awe of other people and inspired by others, and I think that's how I kind of get a lot of ideas, actually, is through analyzing other people and sort of riffing off what they've said. But I think that something started to bubble up as I was collecting all of this, and I started to form my own ideas and my own approach, and I think it started to burst out with the book. And hopefully, well, yeah, I think it's going to take some getting used to in terms of the press and everything, but just allowing that to come out and to step into that and to own it and to be excited rather than nervous. I think it'll be challenging, but I think that I'm getting ready for it, or I've been building up to this point.
I love that that image of the bubbling up. I think that's beautiful, yeah, because like, there is a sense.
Here they come, these ideas.
Yeah, and also that it's irrepressible, you know, yeah. and that same enthusiasm and curiosity and engagement that you bring to your interviews is what people want to engage with in you as well. I do want to, I'm conscious of time, but I do want to ask you about
I could talk to you interviewing. Forever,
Kate. Oh, that's good, great. Because I just actually, I was kind of going back and doing some research, and I found a wonderful article that you wrote about kind of wisdom from great interviewers about the interviewing process. What have you learned over your time doing these amazing interviews, which you've done? Just, I was looking back through the archive going, my gosh, you've got like everyone in there. You've just like talked to everyone I want to talk to. How did you get all these interviews, other than the fact that you're very good at it? And B, what have you learned about interviewing as you've gone along?
Okay, well, A, it was a nice little staircase approach, I'd say. So I started with interviewing friends, and the friends would then sort of recommend someone, and then I could interview them. So it could kind of go up a level of the staircase. And then once I had enough of a body of interviews, if there was someone I wanted to approach, I could kind of look through the archive and think, okay, well, they're kind of sort of associated with such and such. So I'll name drop them as I approach them. And so it started to just have a momentum there and build up. But there was definitely people that said no. But I think having that staircase, and it was many, many years. And again, something that I picked up and I put down. But when you, I suppose, do it for 6 or 7 years, it's sort of, you have enough of an archive that you can approach different people. And have someone to reference. So I highly recommend that. Start with friends and then build up from there. And then in terms of what I've learnt from interviews, I think that the interestingly comes back to this paying attention, doesn't it, Kate? I think that there's been so many interviews where because I've transcribed them myself and re-listening to the conversation, and you think, oh, why didn't I keep going with that thread and ask about that further? Instead, I sort of turned to the set questions that I might have had and this trajectory that I had to follow, instead of following a thread that was quite interesting that came up. And so encountering that enough times and feeling frustrated by it, I allowed myself to really be listening and be curious and pay attention to try to find those threads a little bit more and draw them out. And I think that's an evolving practice and something I'm still trying to hone, because it's almost like this improvisation. And then yeah, it's interesting now just talking about how that applies to what we're talking about with routines and our days, is that once you sort of pay attention instead of stick to this rigid plan that you had, that's where the juicy, shiny, interesting bits come out. So I think that there's maybe a crossover between the art of the interview and the art of living, perhaps. But yeah, I think being really well prepared is crucial so that you can then improvise and pull out those threads a little bit more, but still have something to circle back to. But I think that, I'm preaching to the choir in terms of you being someone who's absolutely mastered the interview as well.
Oh, but I love that idea too. And you know, clearly we both have it. You go, I just want to, there's an infinite number of people to interview and I want to talk to everybody. But also that you can continue to hone it and go on and on. And even those little bits of wisdom in that article, which I will link to in the show notes, you know, I was like, oh yeah, that's good. Like even just rephrasing a sentence to make it a different way. You know, all of those things, I love them so much. I want to ask a little bit about autonomy. And you mentioned before in the side hustle project, that idea of, did you say that it was peer pressured productivity? Is that the phrase you used?
Yes, that was a little catchphrase that I had for a while.
Yeah, I love that because I think one of the things that I've noticed, one of the tensions about, you know, being a creative is that, you know, that we often work alone and we are also have to be in charge of both the creative side of our business, but also the calendar and the money and all of those other parts as well. But I've noticed, and this has particularly come, I think, with some of the PhD stuff and the opportunities through that, I've been involved in some kind of group writing sessions where we're all on screen, but you know, we're turned off just for the accountability of that idea of working with other people too. So I want to ask how you balance that up in your life. Like, how do you make sure that you've got people who can say to you, okay, your diary's looking a little hectic there, Madeline, like maybe give yourself a break, or that you can bounce ideas off, that you can be accountable. How do you arrange those people or find those people in your world?
I wonder if I'm thinking of this. It's interesting that I think the people who are the best pep talkers for me are those that aren't necessarily working in the creative field. And so just very good friends who can, go down the spiral with you and then think, oh, do you think maybe you're being a little bit hard on yourself there, Madeline, with everything that you've got crammed on your to-do list. And so I think that it's interesting that it can be something that we all share, whether we're pursuing a creative profession or project, or whether we're just in this very pressurized world where there's a lot expected to get done. But I think that in terms of having that accountability, it is just about having, like with side project sessions, that was incredible because it was every fortnight. It was a whole group of people and different people each time that would come along. And so in many ways, it was actually the format that allowed the kind of accountability rather than specific individuals who then knew exactly what you were doing. But I'm just thinking now, I'm just realizing that there's been times in across my career where I have had sort of accountability goal setting, either individuals or groups, where you would share what you wanted to achieve that week or what you want to achieve that month. And people would be very intimately aware of what's on your to-do list. And the idea was to remain accountable. But I actually would find myself, I had to be quite careful in those situations because I would find myself very easily re-gearing to someone else's goal and making that sort of the priority and losing my own, because it's so much easier to focus on someone else and what they want to achieve, that I would sort of, my own goals could easily fall to the background. And so I almost need to be, because I'm quite porous in terms of even side project sessions, it was me kind of helping a whole group of people achieve their goal. And after a while, because it expanded and different cities started to take it on, the admin would be what I would work on in the sessions rather than my own creative project. And so I got to a point where I did have to stop that, and I made it an open access model where people could just get the instructions to do it themselves, because I was again sort of putting someone else's or a collective of people's goals ahead of my own. And so all to say, I think there's been times where in many ways, I do need to find the autonomy myself, because it can get murky working along other people. And then I find that actually I can become accountability resistant as well. So there's sort of two sides to it, in that I can put someone else's goal ahead of my own, but then also if someone else is sort of asking like, oh, how's that going, I can be quite rebellious and not do the thing because there's this expectation from someone else. So I just sort of need to, maybe it's an introverted thing, like I need to kind of be driving it myself and remaining focused on my goal. So I don't know, maybe that's a bit counterintuitive to the accountability advice, but I think it can be really powerful for other people. But I think it's also maybe for the people pleasers, something we need to be careful of.
That's really interesting. I love that insight. And I'm kind of, you know, mulling it over in my own mind at the same time as you're speaking.
I've been very good at being like a human deadline for other people.
Yeah.
But I've never found someone who's been a really good human deadline for me, because I almost don't let it in.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. That doesn't work. I think that your insight in the book and in the podcast, your podcast Routines and Ruts as well, your generosity in being insightful into your own process and things that you have kind of embraced or let go of is one of the great gifts of the book for your readers as well. This is a question without notice, which I probably should have given you notice for, but I wondered if there has been one thing that you have let go of that's been the most profound or the most powerful that you can think of, one habit or routine that you decided was no longer serving you that you got rid of?
Beautiful question. I'm trying to think of the one that has, I think that this is something that really, I wonder if this has a beautiful ripple effect. I'm just trying to decide between a couple.
So. You can give us a couple. I will let you.
I think that
actually these questions, I don't know why I ask them, because I find them so anxiety provoking when I have to choose one thing.
But it's good. It's good to have limitations, isn't
it? True.
So I think that I was so obsessed with being a morning person. I thought that that would mean that I would be able to sort my life out if I could just wake up earlier. And then, you know, I think that there's a lot of, you know, our society is sort of built for morning birds, I was for a very long time obsessed with being someone who could sort of wake up at 5 a.m. Or even 6 a.m. And so I'd set these really ambitiously early alarm clocks. And then when they would ring, I would still be, it would really startle me because it was so early, and I would just press the snooze alarm and then do that thing where you kind of end up oversleeping because you don't get up, and then you kind of have this really uninterrupted sleep, and then you feel a bit groggier, and then it's 8 a.m. instead of 5 in the morning, and then you start the day with this sense of already feeling behind and already feeling guilty or shame that you didn't wake up early. And so I think it was, again, this really simple thing, but I thought it was quite revolutionary to me in my days, is that I can just stop setting the alarm and trust my body to wake up when it's had enough rest. And that's one of the luxuries of working for yourself, is that you don't need to start at a specific time, especially if you don't have a meeting or anything in the morning. And that's why I sort of thought, well, why am I trying to work with these existing structures or these KPIs or applying this sort of 9-to-5 structure to my freelance day, when, as you said, there's so many things that freelancers do need to feel. They need to be the accountant, they need to be the marketer, they need to be the writer. Let's, you know, enjoy the little bits of the benefits that we do have. And so one of them is to not have to set an alarm. And so I embraced that and allowed my body to wake up when it was rested. And then I started to sort of notice my own rhythms. And I find that I am someone who often wakes up at around 7:30. And so then it's just been so much better for my sleep. And just to be able to then wake up and not feel like I'm already behind. And I think that was one of the biggest sources of productivity guilt that I was encountering, was this not being a morning person. But now I can embrace it. I can arrange my day in a different way and do the things that, you know, supposedly you do in the morning at different times. Like if it still happens in the evening, that's something that's fine as well. Like, why does it have to be that it happens in the morning? So I think letting go of alarm clocks, has been the thing. And it's such a nicer way to wake up in the day.
I love that.
Yeah.
I love
that. Even if you are someone who has to be somewhere at 9, it's interesting to see whether maybe your body would wake you up anyway, even without the alarm clock. I don't know. You could tell your boss, hey, I'm going to experiment with not having an alarm clock. Let's see if I can get to work on time.
Yes. Normally I have a child on my head at some point, but the joy of that too is that even just entering into school holidays and suddenly realizing how much even the kids' sleeping habits are to do with that, you know, okay, everyone up, and just that kind of joy of okay, we don't have plans today. Such a beautiful kind of restful thing. I'm conscious that one of the things that happens sometimes when we do this, okay, I'm gonna change the way that I'm doing my life, is that it is all about letting things go and getting rid of things and kind of like a social media diet or something like that. And that it's not necessarily that. So I also want to ask you the counter, which is, what have you let in to your life, or what have you asked? What have you embraced more of, I suppose, in this new kind of, I didn't do the thing today approach to the world?
Oh, how nice. What are you letting in? Oh, I love that. That's a good sort of New Year's resolution question to ask yourself, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like, instead of what are you going to let go of, what are you going to let in this year?
What do you want more of?
What do you want more of? Yeah, rather the less and more. I think it's been letting in, it's almost like the letting go, they work in tandem. So the letting go creates more space, and then more space allows for more surprise. And so letting in more surprise, and letting in more surprise is kind of scary, because a surprise can be a good thing, but it can also be a scary thing. Mm. It can be a tragic thing, you know. So surprises can come in all shapes and sizes. But when it's a good surprise, it's a wonderful thing. Even if it's just, you know, a flirtation with someone, I count as a surprise, because it's a surprising encounter. And so I think, letting in more surprises, and be that I like to count kind of surprising emails like things surprising emails in terms of sometimes you'll get an email and it will be this opportunity that you never would have imagined, or it'll be some nice words, and I think that can be a wonderful buoying thing. It's so lovely when you see people around you, and I've witnessed this in many friends and family, where suddenly it's almost overnight their life has changed. Like something happened where maybe they left a relationship, or maybe they left a job, or they've just sort of, their attitude has sort of shifted slightly, and all of a sudden they're living a different life. And I think that's the beautiful thing about that, sort of surprises can turn us in all these different directions, just like the surprise email. So I think that's what I've let in more, because I'm allowing for it more, because I'm not planning as much. I still will always have a to-do list, because it's something that calms my anxious brain, but I've seen it for what it is, in terms of like, this is just something I need to sort of calm myself, but I know that it's actually not helping in terms of doing the work at all. Like, it doesn't, just because I've written the list doesn't then mean I kind of bound into like a deep work session or anything. It's a tool that serves a different purpose to then actually getting the things done. So I think that, letting in more surprises is a good one, even to keep that going for the new year, perhaps.
Oh, I love that. I love that. Other than like going out immediately and making sure that they have a copy of your beautiful new book, I Didn't Do the Thing Today, if our listeners are thinking, okay, it's January, it's the start of a new year, we've had pretty much a shitty time, lots of people have been having a shitty time, I want to bring some of this new thinking into my new year, where would you suggest that they can gently kind of begin?
Gently, I just thought of gentle and small going hand in hand. Yeah. So I think at the new year, there's this tendency to completely upend our lives, like turn it all over, like out with the old, in with the new, and we just kind of completely rearrange our lives, and have this expectation that it's going to be a new year and a new us. And we won't even recognize ourselves. But I think, you know, reminding ourselves that we still are the same people, even in a new year. And so instead of sort of completely 180-ing our lives, we can just add small good things. And I think that it has been so hard for people, and maybe it will continue to be hard. And so instead of expecting things to be different or for ourselves to be different, just adding a small good thing. So I speak about this in the book of just adding a small good thing to our days rather than expecting completely overhaul them, and starting to maybe you can do that by, so say it is a difficult time, and so maybe taking note of the flashes or the moments where we do feel good or we feel lighter or we feel like, wait a second, I'm having fun, or wow, that was a surprise, or oh, that was, you know, I felt curious in that moment. So taking note of the times that we do feel good, and then we can have this little list going, and that's a list of our small, good, ordinary things that we can start collecting, and they can steady us in moments, especially during difficult times. There's these tiny little things that we can hold on to. So I think that would be my suggestion, is to look for the small, good things, or even just start very, very small rather than expecting yourself to completely change overnight on December 31st. Maybe just look for the things that, I don't know, that make you feel good rather than the things that you need to change, that you want to let in rather than let go of even.
Yeah, I love that, letting in the small good things. Madeline Dorr, I cannot let you go without asking, as we always ask, if you can please recommend to us a debut book, any time or any genre, that you would like to share with our listeners.
Oh, I love this question that you ask people. And I couldn't whittle it down, but then it was interesting that there was these three that came to mind, and they all had this shared thing in common that surprised me. So
these words, the surprise, the synchronicity, it's perfect.
Oh,
tell
I love
us.
The synchronicity. So they all happened to share in common that there were books that took a very long time for the authors to write. So there's Ingrid Fertel Lee, who wrote The Aesthetics of Joy. It took her 10 years to write that. It was a graduate thesis that then turned into a book 10 years later. But I interviewed her, and it was so comforting to me, because I hadn't yet done my book proposal, but I'd been thinking about it for years and years and years. And I'd even had an agent and then lost that agent because she'd moved on to other things without me having even finished the proposal. And that happened with Ingrid Fertel Lee as well. And reading her book, I was like, it was worth the wait, because in that time that she wasn't writing the book and she was losing the agent and needing to find another one, she was collecting more and more insights about what does joy look like. And I think that she could only write that book, and she's the only one that could write that book, because she sat with it long enough. And then there's also Lisa Tadeo, who wrote Three Women. Have you read that?
I have. Oh, I have.
So extraordinary. And I just think that that for me changed what nonfiction could look like and what the art of the interview could look like, in terms of staying with these women for, I think it was 8 years, and then really going deep. And then you read that and it reads like fiction. It's just beautiful. And so that took a long time. And then there's Susan Cain, I heard, I think it was 7 years it took her to write Quiet. And she had two children in between that time of having the book deal. And she even wrote the whole book, and the editor said, you're going to have to do that all over again and take the time that you need to take. And that's quite the power of interviews, I thought, was a really fantastic read as well. And so I think they're all combined, these fantastic nonfiction texts, and it just goes to show that anything worthwhile takes a long time. And I think that that's been a comfort for me in terms of, you know, and the different iterations of what I thought this book could be. I needed to finish the process. I needed to get to the other side of productivity. It started with me searching for the secret to being more productive. And then it completely flipped to, wait, it's our search for being perfectly productive that's the problem. And I needed to finish that journey, I suppose, to then be able to write the book that I've written. And I'm glad I wrote this book and not another version of the book, which was maybe going to be how to be productive, whereas this is feels far more congruent with my outlook and philosophy. So that's my first time debut, but three, and the lesson is the thread.
I love that lesson. I love what you can do with a thread, Madeline Dorr. I don't know, people won't be able to see this, but I hope you can hear it in my voice, listeners, that I don't think I've stopped grinning since we started talking, because I just feel like it's such a very special thrill to speak with you, Madeline Dorr. And we're so excited about releasing this interview as our first for the new year, because you've just written the most wonderful book. And thank you for sharing that enormous journey that is behind it as well. I hope that you let in lots and lots of good things for the new year.
Thank you, Kate. And likewise, it's such a joy to be on this podcast. It's one of my favorites. And I love the work that you do and the questions that you ask. And you're just one of the most beautiful interviewers. So thank you.
Oh, thank you.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.